This is New World Notes. The fine British reporter Robert Fisk died October 20th, 2020. He covered the Middle East with impressive factual knowledge and great integrity. The moment the United States declared war on the region in 1990, American reporters pretty uniformly turned themselves into mere propagandists. Robert Fisk's reporting was a good antidote to the rest. Let us celebrate the late Robert Fisk by reaching into our archives and rebroadcasting this installment from February 2019. The installment is titled simply, Robert Fisk and Chris Hedges. Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, words of wisdom from two fine reporters, Robert Fisk and Chris Hedges. I hope you'll stay tuned. The full title of this installment is Robert Fisk and Chris Hedges, Taking on the Scoundrels. To be clear, Fisk and Hedges are not the scoundrels. They're the parties taking them on. Both men are highly regarded journalists. Robert Fisk is still a working reporter. He is Middle East correspondent for the English newspaper The Independent. Chris Hedges was formerly a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He is now a regular columnist for Truthdig Online. These days, the two take on the scoundrels in different ways. Fisk remains the meticulous reporter, seeking precise details about exactly who did what, when, where, how. Hedges, though, increasingly pursues the broader picture concerning democracy, society, the corporate oligarchs, and so on. Despite their different styles, the two men explicitly agree on two points. One, the citizens are drowning in a sea of lies and propaganda. And number two, President Trump is a disaster for the United States and the world. Robert Fisk has appeared too seldom on New World Notes. It is a pleasure to have him back. Here he speaks in June 2018 with Jeff Blankford on Jeff's radio show, Takes on the World. They discuss current affairs, but begin with an incident that happened on Fisk's newsbeat in July 1988. The U.S. Navy cruiser Vincennes shot down an Iranian passenger jet on a scheduled flight, killing 290 people. Fisk resigned from the London Times over the paper's lies about the incident. Robert Fisk.
Yes. You said I resigned from the Times in opposition to Rupert Murdoch's purchase of the paper. That is not true. Rupert Murdoch had purchased the paper many years before. I resigned from the Times because they declined to publish a front-page story, which they originally wanted to, saying that an Iranian Airbus had been shot down over the Gulf, this is in 1988, by an American warship because the American captain had panicked. They preferred to run an editorial saying that the pilot of the Iranian passenger plane was a suicide pilot, which wasn't true. And inquiry by the U.S. did prove indeed that the American warship crew had been panicking as they fired at the passenger aircraft. As a result of that, the Times did not carry my story, which was true, although Irish papers did, and I resigned from the Times and joined the Independent. It was nothing to do with Murdoch himself, though, of course, his influence was very obviously over the paper.
Well, thank you for clarifying that and recalling that story. The USS Vincennes shot down the Iranian passenger plane. It's a story we don't hear about, and thanks for bringing it up. You know, Tuesday's love-in in Singapore with Kim Jong-un has been grabbing the headlines and monopolizing our airwaves. And I've been feeling this may be a sideshow to make Americans less aware of what's happening in the Middle East, which you've been writing about with regard to Iran and Syria. What's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, because a very dear colleague of mine made the point yesterday while watching this nonsense on television that this might be about Iran. This might be a way of being able to push the American line that Iran is the, you know, the dangerous nuclear power, by showing that, in fact, it's possible to defang, as the Americans like to say, North Korea's nuclear powers. It's interesting that the man who is prepared to talk to a tyrant who has nuclear weapons, not just is wants to develop them, but who's got nuclear weapons, and who carries out atrocious human rights abuses, that Trump should be prepared to talk to him, but to actually tear up an agreement which has prevented Iran from manufacturing nuclear weapons, and of course having no interest at all in talking to the Iranians.
Well, you know, we hear and read on a regular basis, like a mantra, that not only is Iran the leading sponsor of state terror, but that it essentially now controls both Syria and Lebanon, where you live. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's rubbish. The problem is now that this story, I suppose the cliche is, this narrative has become so widespread, so accepted by not just all the mountebank experts in New York and the various, you know, presenters on television and the New York Times and so on and so forth, that it's become the truth. Now, you know, I travel all the front lines of Syria, and I last saw a few Iranian Revolutionary Guards, maybe 12, on the front lines southwest of Aleppo well over a year ago. Since then, east of Aleppo, west of Aleppo, Deir ez-Zor, Palmyra, Tadmor, Homs, Hama, Damascus, with the exception of a few Iranian guards near the site of Zainab Mosque in Damascus, I haven't seen any. I doubt if there's as many even as 3,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guards or soldiers inside Syria. You know, it oddly reminds me of what happened in 1941 when the British and the other allies invaded Lebanon, which of course was under the Vichy French Pétainist pro-Hitler regime. And the first British officer to capture some French soldiers said, "Where are the Germans?" And the French officer said, "But there aren't any Germans in Lebanon." Well, there are very few Iranians in Syria, but now everyone has got so used to hearing that they are that they talk about the tens of thousands of Iranian troops in Syria. Now, there are lots of Hezbollah in Syria, and I see them in action, and I see them at Kalamoon on the Lebanese border, and I know they come home many, in many cases, dead in coffins. And there's been some considerable unrest among their families as to what they're dying for in Syria when they're, theoretically, they claim to be defending southern Lebanon from Israel. But again, the Hezbollah are under a Lebanese leadership. Although clearly financed by Iran and armed by Iran, they have considerable leeway. If they didn't want to be in Syria, they wouldn't be there. And I don't think you can see them as an automatic arm of Iran. However, once you have a civil war, as you did have, of course, in Lebanon between 1975 and 1990, every foreign power becomes involved. The Iranians have been involved in Syria. The Hezbollah have been involved. The Americans are involved. The Kurds are involved. The Turks are involved. The Saudis are involved. The Qataris are involved. The French apparently have some troops on the ground, though we don't hear much about them. You know, if you're going to start picking on who has the largest forces, I'd say, well, have a look at Turkey. And they're bringing ISIS, Daesh people, back into Syria. And Turkey's meant to be, or supposed to be, a NATO nation, which it is, and an ally of the United States.
That brings up an article, a very interesting article you wrote about how Trump has opened the door for Putin in the Middle East. And how it's amazing how Putin is able to maintain close relationships with practically every country in the Middle East, even those who are at odds with each other, like Israel and Iran. He's close to Assad, but he's actually very close to Benjamin Netanyahu. I think he's had 7 state visits, and that's one thing the U.S. media has underplayed, because it'd be very difficult to explain to the American public why they love Netanyahu, and love Netanyahu and Putin seem to get on very well together. Talk about how Putin has kind of, you call him the man for all seasons, how he has managed to, with kind of a charm offensive, to be welcome everywhere.
Well, you can be a man for all seasons if your opposite number in the White House is a crackpot. And the problem, of course, as we all know, though very few journalists seem to say this quite as bluntly, is that the president of the United States is crazy. He's insane. He should be in a mental establishment. And as a result of that, his leadership of the free world, which used to be the phrase we used about America under Kennedy, Eisenhower, even George W. Bush, doesn't exist. And in this kind of vacuum, I hate to use the word vacuum even, but in this kind of emptiness, this void, men like Putin, who have ambitions to recast their countries as large, powerful nations, can fulfill themselves. And of course, in the Middle East itself, where most leaders, however much they may fawn on Trump, realize he's crackers, they know that they've got to deal with Putin. When an event takes place in the Middle East now, Arabs don't say, oh, what will Trump say? They're sick of reading tweets and they're not interested. They say, what is Putin going to say? And Putin's played it quite skillfully. He's not a very nice guy, but he's a shrewd man. He has a brain. And he's decided he's going to be everyone's friend. And so he can go to Iran and greet the supreme leader. He can be greeted by Netanyahu in Jerusalem. He can call Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister of Israel, who's a racist, as a great Russian, because, of course, he originally came from the Soviet Union. What was the Soviet Union? He can make Erdogan into his friend after Erdogan shoots down a plane and Putin threatens to bankrupt Turkey. He can go to see Sisi, the dictator of Cairo, and be taken out to the opera to watch Verdi, which Sisi did at the opera house in Cairo. So Putin is in a very interesting situation. Now, people say, oh, well, you know, he was very angry about what happened in Libya, where he let, effectively, NATO wipe out Gaddafi and thus lost his Russian rights to Mediterranean ports of Benghazi and Tripoli. I'm not sure he cares much about that. I think Putin is much more concerned about what he calls Islamist terror. You see, we think of the Middle East as being, well, we think of Syria as being in the Middle East, but if you go to Moscow, which I do occasionally, Damascus is due south, and if you look south from the Kremlin, first you see Chechnya, the great Muslim threat to the Russian Federation, and just beyond you see the spires of Damascus. And of course, Syria is the one country where Russia does still have a warm water Mediterranean port, that's Tartus, and now, of course, the Hamamine Air Base as well. And so Assad, not Assad as you keep calling it, like all of Assad, does find he's got a loyal ally in Moscow. Remember, Putin doesn't have a lot of time for people who run away. The president of the Ukraine simply disappeared when he ran away. Putin didn't try to prop him up. But Assad has not fled, and Putin props him up. Now, maybe he'd prefer someone other than Assad. If I was Putin, I probably would. But that's what he's got. And the fact is that with Russian military assistance and a lot of air bombing, a lot of good training, as the Russians themselves admit, for their military forces, the Syrian government army, or the Syrian Arab army, as its official name is, has turned the tables on the armed opposition to Assad, whether that be Nusra, which is al-Qaeda, whether it be Daesh, which we call ISIS, whether it be the ghostly and rather imaginative Free Syrian Army, which doesn't really exist anymore, or other Islamist groups, they're on the run and they've largely been beaten. They haven't been totally conquered any more than they have in Iraq by the Kurds and the Americans and the Iraqi army. But they've pretty much been wiped out in the major cities of Syria. And Putin, of course, if you drive around the streets of Aleppo, you see Putin's picture everywhere. If you go to a checkpoint, people say, Rus, Rusi, Rusi, and wave you through. Obviously, I look a bit like a Russian because I'm a European. And you'll find that there's now, even in Syria, there's a military newspaper run by the Russians in Arabic for the Syrian and Russian armies together, teaching Syrian soldiers about Moscow and giving them how to learn Russian and teaching them, you know, various words in Russian and translating them back into Arabic for Russian soldiers. I mean, you cannot avoid seeing how close the Russians and the Syrian military are when you're in Syria itself. And that, of course, is obviously what Putin intended. When I was in Aleppo last, I found a number of Russian military intelligence officers researching the results of the bomb craters made by their explosives in eastern Aleppo. And they made it clear to me that their reports did not go to the FSB or military intelligence first. They went straight to the Kremlin. In other words, Putin is a micromanager. He wants to know everything that's going on. You can't say that about Trump, can you?
I very much doubt that. No, I know you have to run, but any kind of last words of warning, advice to American listeners who are fed a steady diet of propaganda?
Well, they have to make up their own minds what to do. It's not for a Brit who wanders around the Middle East to tell Americans what to think. thinking of American elections, I look back to the time when Winston Churchill and FDR met to draw up the Atlantic Charter, and FDR was trying to get his presidency again, of course, another election. And the Republicans were claiming, in an attempt to, you know, stop FDR's chances of winning the election, that he was worse than Hitler. And if you see that kind of propaganda going on against a sitting U.S. president during the Second World War, what kind of propaganda is floating around today? You know, they didn't have social media in World War II. You have to ask yourself, hold on a second, what does this mean? Are you reading and seeing everything that's available? That doesn't mean sit on social media and read claptrap like, you know, conspiracy theorists and so on. But at least there are people out there who are trying. I'm not the only journalist who's trying to do what I'm trying to do, which is say, hold on a second, there's another side to the story. There always is. And the final point will be on casualty figures. I still see casualty figures of the Syrian war at 250,000, 350,000, 400,000. The latter comes from the so-called, what is it, Observatory on Human Rights, run by a guy in Coventry in England. But I also remember, for example, reading that when the Nazi Luftwaffe bombed Rotterdam in 1940, the casualty figures were 19,000 dead. When they got the Luftwaffe officers on trial at Nuremberg in 1946, a year after the Second World War, the dead were less than 1,000. In other words, they were exaggerated 19 times for the whole of the Second World War. Good reason, of course, you weren't able to go to Rotterdam and count the dead. The Germans occupied Rotterdam. But we've got to be careful of all the figures and all the dates and all the times, and that includes casualty figures.
Propaganda, propaganda. If you want to fool the folks, it comes in handy. If you want to tell some lies, pull the wool over their eyes, you can do it with propaganda, propaganda, propaganda. You can liberate the babies from their candy. It's so easy, it's a sin, you're gonna wanna jump right in. You can always depend on propaganda. Life is so hard, so confusing. Everyone's just trying to make ends meet. You can brighten up their day, keep the facts out of their way. Just simplify the complex, repeat, repeat, repeat. Propaganda. Propaganda. If you need to change a subject, it's a dandy. If you want to wag the dog, it's like falling off a log. It's so easy with propaganda. Propaganda, propaganda. Try and convince the folks the beach is never sandy. You can convert into lies what they seen with their own eyes. It's amazing. Propaganda. Life is so complex, so confusing. Everyone's just trying to make ends meet. You can brighten up their day, keep the facts out of their way. Just simplify the complex, repeat, repeat, repeat. Propaganda, propaganda. Goes down easy like a snifter of old brandy. Gotta learn how to tinker with that hook, line, and sinker for easy to swallow propaganda. If you want to stir the pot, make it look like you're not. Just add a shot of propaganda. If you want to rule the roost and you need a little boost, I recommend propaganda. Propaganda.
Now there's an oldie. It's by Yikes McGee, released back in the days of W. Bush. Those days seem to be a golden age of political propaganda, if golden is the right shade of brown for it. Back when 100 million Americans were persuaded that Iraq was on the very verge of blasting us all to kingdom come, and that the former American puppet Saddam Hussein engineered the attacks on the World Trade Center. Now comes the Trump administration. Now we're getting a steady diet of something, but what? It's hard to tell if it's propaganda or simply news from some alternative universe. all those Al-Qaeda terrorists, dirty bombs in hand, plus thousands of rapists crossing the Rio Grande and hiking through the Arizona desert in 110-degree heat, cleverly disguised as poor, desperate children from Honduras. So let us give thanks to dedicated and honest journalists such as Robert Fisk and Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges has appeared frequently on New World Notes. Two very recent installments carried a hard-hitting speech of his titled America, the Farewell Tour. Today, let's hear two different snippets from the question and answer session that followed. In the speech, Hedges had called for the people to unite to nonviolently resist and overturn the corporate rule of America. Apparently, one questioner asked, exactly how do we go about doing this? Here is Hedges' reply.
When you can, day after day, as was true in East Germany, or was true in Prague, get 500,000 people shutting down the center of the city. And of course, nonviolence is key. And what has hurt the Paris protests has been both from the far left and the far right, the anarchists and the far right, who have carried out property destruction and burnt cars. This is a gift to the state. That didn't happen in Eastern. It didn't happen in East Germany and Czechoslovakia. Romania was a little different, where I also was. So it's essentially the South African understanding of non-cooperation. It is creating disciplined, peaceful, massive, sustained protests. And the danger of that, as all of the theorists, and what I'm talking about is revolution, but the danger of that, as all of the theorists of revolution have noted, for Crane Brinton, Jeffrey Davies, and others, all of whom say that no revolution succeeds until a significant portion of the ruling apparatus defects, or at least is neutralized, is not willing to defend the regime. And this took place in East Germany in September of 1989, when Erich Honecker, the dictator, sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig with orders to fire on the demonstrators. When the paratroopers got there, the city authorities refused to deploy them in the streets. Honecker was out of power within a week. The same was true in Czechoslovakia. Once it was clear that the security forces would not defend the discredited communist elites, they were done for. And so that's why nonviolence is key. And you just go back through the history of every revolution, and they have succeeded because of these defections, which creates paralysis within the mechanisms of ruling power. So I was at Standing Rock. I write about Standing Rock. That's a very good example, 7 months of nonviolent resistance led by a deeply spiritual, and I think that spiritual element is important, by Native American leaders. And all there, you know, there were 10,000 people when I was there, about half of them were white people, but the Native American elders were quite astute about making them sit through long lectures about what they were doing and why and the tactics they would use. So it's rebuilding those mass movements, which really is our only hope. You've seen flashes of it. You saw it with the teachers' strikes in places like West Virginia. Never forget that they defied their union leadership, who wanted to accept the contract. You saw it a few years ago with the teachers' strike in Chicago. But really, that's it, because that's the only way that we're going to succeed is to pit power against power, and the only power we have is that we're a lot more than they are.
A final question about economic justice versus social justice.
Economic justice versus social justice, King wouldn't have made that distinction. King was quite clear that there would not be an end to racism until there was economic justice. And of course, when King crossed over, especially after he denounced the Vietnam War, that white liberal base fled from him as if he had leprosy, because they were willing to accept desegregation in the South, but they weren't willing to take the next step, which was, in essence, to give to African Americans the reparations they are long overdue. And affirmative action, as Johnson said in his speech at Howard University when he announced it, was designed as reparations. It's been distorted and disfigured to be about diversity. It was never about diversity. It was about accepting the fact that white Americans owe African Americans a lot. They built the damn country, first of all. In the same way that Germany accepted its responsibility for what it had done to the Jews in World War II. We've never done it historically. So I don't make that distinction. I think the fact that the boutique activism of the left has focused on multiculturalism and identity politics to the exclusion of economic justice is why people of color often have such disdain for the white liberal class. And I saw that in Zuccotti Park. So Zuccotti Park was, which I supported. I mean, I love those kids. But it was largely a middle-class, college-educated, driven white. And for the first time, it's what Bakunin called déclassé intellectuals, people who expected to find a place within the elite systems and then found there was no place for them. And this is kind of arcane, but Marx and Bakunin went back and forth. Marx saying hated déclassé intellectuals, Bakunin arguing, I think correctly, that they are vital to fusing any successful revolutionary movement. But you didn't find poor people of color from East New York or there, because what those white kids were experiencing, which was underemployment, unemployment, lack of benefits, evictions, are something that had been going on going back several decades into poor communities under neoliberalism in particular. And we got diverted, I'm talking about white people, and got caught up. We forgot the primacy of economic justice. So I think that division has hurt us. And it's something that the great radicals like King understood.
Thus ends our look at two fine journalists, the UK's Robert Fisk and America's own Chris Hedges. They differ in style, but are alike in their quest for truth, in their hatred of lies and propaganda, and in their dislike of the wackos who are now running the Western world. Many thanks to Jeff Blankfort of Takes on the World for the Fisk interview, and thanks again to Wilton Vaught of Other Voices, Other Choices for re-engineering and sharing Chris Hedges' audio. You can find more of our own audio at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.